It's Friday, January 27th, 2017. I am Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press and Raging Chicken Media. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. Well, it's week two since the Trump Organization took control of the White House, and the fire hose is still on full blast. This week, we saw an explosion of international instability as Trump threatened to, you know, invade Mexico. And he hung up on the Australian prime minister because of fatigue. I was a little bit fatigued. And the tapes of Bannon emerge once again of him about discussing the inevitability of war with China. And that has been making its rounds throughout the media. The State Department is now fused with Big Oil in the confirmation of Exxon's CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Can see nothing but good things coming out of that. And we're on our way to confirming a white supremacist to run the Justice Department, a mortgage fraudster to run the Department of the Treasury, and an anti-EPA warrior to run the EPA. That's all coming up this week, folks. Jesus Christ. And if that doesn't even scratch the surface, right? Not to mention, wait, alt facts rule the day once again. Didn't you hear about the massacre of Bowling Green, everybody? Of course you didn't, because the media didn't cover it, right? But this past week has also been dominated by nonstop protests. Right after we got off the air last week in the podcast, right, Trump announced like the kind of ban on Muslims, right? And then we saw a mass eruption of protests across the country. Airports and town squares across the country were occupied by thousands of protesters who came out against Trump's order and to stand in solidarity with Muslim refugees, immigrants, and travelers. We'll talk about some of the actions here in Pennsylvania, from the growing Tuesday with Toomey protest to mass rallies from Philadelphia to Lancaster, right? Or Lancaster, if you're from around these parts. Senator Toomey's phone lines crash or were shut off due to a flood of calls urging him to stand against Betsy DeVos's nomination for Secretary of Education. Toomey, in turn, blows off his constituents. It doesn't stop there. If you thought it stopped there, you're insane, okay? And you have not been paying attention. Because while news cycles, right, have been buried by the unyielding assaults from the White House, here in PA, the state legislature is moving closer to approving extreme anti-abortion legislation. Yeah, that's right. You remember that, right? Yeah, that's what the Republicans were up to last year. PA state system of higher education sets the stage for dismantling or gutting the 14 state-owned university system. And right in my own backyard, faculty at Kutztown University demonstrate the value of, quote, pissing in your own backyard in their fight for safe and healthy working conditions. All that and so much more. Yes, so much more on today's show. Now, remember, folks, we need you. We need you right now. I mean, one, for our baseline level of sanity, okay? We need you. But we need you to help keep progressive activist media going strong, right? We need you to become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $2 a month. Come in at the $5 a month level and you really start making an impact. Simply go to ragingchickenpress.org and look for the support and membership tab. Click become a member, right? And you can become a member. We're also on Patreon. So if you're someone who loves Patreon, go right through Patreon and click become a patron under the same tab. Or if you're not ready to become a member, but you want to contribute, you can make a one-time donation simply by clicking donate. I can't tell you how much that helps. And for a limited time, you can pick up our exclusive Alternative Facts Are Lies t-shirt over at Teespring. But you need to do it in the next 5 days, right? Because then the sale is off, right? We've already reached the threshold, so those shirts will be printing. Get on over there in the next 5 days to pick it up, and all proceeds from t-shirt sales go directly to support our awesome team of writers. So go over on there and pick them up. And next week, we'll be launching a new exclusive design, and I think this is going to be a regular thing because this is how I keep my sanity. So stay tuned, everybody. We are digging in for 2017 in Trumplandia, and I'm telling you, the trenches are going to need to be reinforced, and we need you. We need the progressive community to help us deepen the pull no punches progressive media that will hold power accountable. So, Sean, I you know, welcome, I guess.
Can I make one comment before we start?
Please go.
It's Lancaster. Get fucking right.
I can't. I don't, look, I'm not from these parts. I'm not from these parts.
One of the best things I've heard in a while. It's gallows humor. We can't keep it straight. We're like, we're just marching off the cliff, and it's like, what else can you do but laugh at this point?
What the hell? I might as well be playing music as you go down. I mean, you know, I mean,
have the drummer boy and the flute up front and just start like marching with the flag. Just,
I feel like I'm like, you know, that little
it's like that marching band. Animal House, the marching band, where they just go right into the wall. I feel like that's us right now. We're just marching right into the wall and bending all the instruments. And
exactly. It's like the classical classical quartet on the deck of the Titanic. You know, I mean, it's like, what the heck do you do? So, I mean, I don't even know where to start. I mean, if we just kind of look at, you know, what has happened. I mean, let's start with just, I mean, I don't know where to start. I mean, I'm just looking at, you're looking at the fact that in any kind of normal administration, right, we would be focused right now on the controversy around appointing the CEO of the world's biggest oil company to run the Secretary of State, someone who's had no political experience, someone who has massive investments in oil properties around the world.
Someone who's part co-owner of Rosneft, Russia's largest state-owned oil company.
Exactly. That's what we would be talking about in any semblance of normal times.
I mean, I don't see any conflicts of interest with that. Rosneft and CEO Rex Tillerson, when, you know, Enron or ExxonMobil having a 49% ownership in the company.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And it's not only that, right? Let's talk about, I mean, the fact that what we have with Rex Tillerson, right, it not only is ExxonMobil the world's giant oil company, not only are all those conflict of interest kind of like staring everyone blatant, like right in the face, but Exxon, as like Steve Horn over at the Smog Blog has been reporting, as a bunch of other folks have been reporting, Exxon was at the forefront of the climate denial industry. Right. When Exxon knew. Right. You know, remember that whole kind of, God,
oh, this is like 30 years ago.
Yeah. 30 years ago, they knew. Right. Their own scientists knew and warned about what was going to be happening with global warming and how this is real, and what they're going to need to do about it. Exxon chose to deny. First, they're like, oh, OK. But then I said, you know what? That's not in our interest of our bottom line. We're going to suppress that stuff. And we're actually going to soak millions and millions of dollars in building institutions and supporting the climate denial industry. This is the guy who is now the Secretary of State. You know, I mean, that's normal times. That would be the biggest scandal. Right now, we're talking about Trump, you know, through his, you know, proclamations on Twitter and other things, threatening to invade Mexico. Right. I mean, well, we might have to come and get them. Right.
Or like, how do you fuck relations with Australia of all places?
Australia. Right. I mean, really. And like what comes out afterwards when people realize, or some people, whoever it is in his little, like, you know, internal group, decide like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best thing. The explanation is like, well, I was a little bit fatigued. I was just a little bit fatigued and I just had to hang up the phone. You know, I'm like, are you kidding me? So, okay. So that was normal times. This is not normal times. We have, you know, I think a real crisis on our hands here. And what's incredibly difficult at this point is just keeping up with stuff. And I think there's a danger too, as well, of trying to keep up with all this craziness that's coming out of the White House and it's coming out of DC, and following along with the announcements and the executive orders and so on, and talking about how crazy the Trump administration is or the Trump organization is, which of course they are, but then not paying attention to the consequences.
And one of the things I want to know is, like, you know, we have all these crazy things going on. Like, you know, like just what, yesterday, 2 days ago, you have Kellyanne Conway going on TV talking about the Bowling Green massacre, which she talked about a football game or something when Bowling Green got blown out. But like, do they actually believe this stuff, or are they making this up intentionally to distract people, divert people, but also get their base believing anything they'll say? I mean,
that's what it is.
But this is a group of people who still think that Obama's responsible for 9/11. So if you feed them any lie, they're obviously going to accept it.
That's exactly right. This is what we're seeing. The alternative facts quote that came out from Kellyanne Conway last week. We're seeing that take shape and what that actually looks like. So let's take two examples of this, right? You look at the Bowling Green massacre, right? Which she had the gall to say that we don't know about this because the media ignored it and didn't pay attention to that. So of course you can't go back and fact check it because the media didn't report on it. So there's no record of it. I mean, it's like, it's incredibly circular, but the important part about that, if you look at where that came from, at least most likely the Washington Post is reporting on this, is that there were two individuals who were from Bowling Green, right, who were who pled guilty to aiding and abetting kind of Al-Qaeda by providing weapons or something along these lines, right? That was a case from a few years back, right? And then so but it had nothing to do with them attacking people in Bowling Green. Those two folks were from Bowling Green, right? There was no massacre. Right. There was some suggestion that they had participated in some attacks, potentially some attacks on U.S. troops abroad. Right. There was those things that were going on. So there's enough stuff in the record, in the media record, where the right can take it and run with that. It has names to associate with the quote unquote Bowling Green massacre. It has ties with Al-Qaeda that's pulling out this, but what Kellyanne Conway is doing is they're reassembling this stuff in a different kind of narrative, right? To kind of, you know, fan the flames of the base. That is extraordinarily, extraordinarily dangerous. Because this is how, you know, how conspiracy theories work. This is how authoritarian dictatorships work, is they take kind of nominal facts, right, and they reassemble them in such a way where there's enough doubt, right, of like, well, are they telling us, is this a complete fabrication or is this lie? And they can point to specific documents. And, you know, again, look, most people, you know, don't read all this stuff. All they see is here's a person who was convicted in this particular thing, and now they believe this story about, you know, the Bowling Green massacre, which, by the way, people in Bowling Green were astonished to learn about. So I mean that, you know,
like, so it's like underneath their rug for a little bit, and they're just like, oh man, I didn't even know this was here.
No, that's exactly.
Look at this shiny coin I found on the ground.
Exactly. How'd we miss that? was that what that siren was last Saturday? Missed it, right? I can't believe they kept it from us right down the street, right? I mean, that's pretty crazy. You know, and so the ways that information is being assembled is just insane. The other one was from the you know, about the Muslim ban, right? The narrative that the right has been circling around is the fact that, you know, and this initiated by the Trump organization, was that this is actually something from Obama, right? And this is not from Obama. Obama didn't have a Muslim ban, right? The only thing that was there from the Obama administration was the fact that there's like 34 countries or something like this that do not need a visa to come to this country, mostly European countries. However, Obama said, okay, if you are, say, for example, you're a German, right? You're a German, and then you travel to Yemen, and then from Yemen, you go to the United States, then you need a visa, right? That was the extent of what that order is. But again, just enough truth that they can craft a narrative around in order to kind of, like, you know, hoodwink the American people and fan the flames of their own base. It's crazy, Sean.
Yeah, this is really nuts with the alternative fact stuff. Because even out here talking to people on an ordinary basis, you know, they're picking up on this, well, Obama has his own Muslim ban type of rhetoric. And I'm like, no, Obama did not have his Muslim ban. He did some, yes, bad things, but he never did this before where he completely signed a sweeping executive order denying people with green cards and visas from these countries to come into the United States, you know, non-citizens, even people with with actual passports or actual visas that went through the process. And it's really interesting seeing how people are responding to this out here, because you live out here in Central PA, and you could see that right wing narrative get picked up pretty easily, even by people who are pretty apolitical.
Yeah,
it's just really interesting. You have to beat that back. Like, no, he's like, well, it's Trump. Someone said, well, Trump's doing what he said he was going to do. Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing, but he's banning the Muslims. Like, it's not something that, you know.
No, exactly. And I think this is the right-wing media strategy, right? I mean, basically what they put out a powerful narrative out there that their base is already going to bite on, And then there's this argument that goes back and forth, which appears like there's just two sides, right? One side believes this because this is what they see. The other side believes this because that's what they see. And then it's just an endless, like, just discussion, debate, but it's over nonsense. And I think that what happens a lot with progressives, if progressives get kind of, you know, stuck in arguing over the facts, right? Arguing over, no, trying to prove all this other kind of stuff, which you have to do, right? But in the meantime, the other side is not, they have no investment in the facts. They have no investment in what's real. They have the only investment in kind of like that kind of ideological bent. Which is why, once again, that the only response you can really say to the Trump administration, right, to the Trump organization, to the kind of right-wing media assault that we see, is the kind of organizing that we see. That's the only thing that's making its way through.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, it's exactly right. Out here in central Pennsylvania, I've seen a lot of people who are motivated for the first time to get involved in activism. You know, we're seeing stuff with the Tuesday with Toomey and, you know, the immigration rallies across Philadelphia, Lancaster, and across the state, you know, when people go into holding vigils or going to the airports. It's interesting seeing how the rapid mobilization has been going with this, you know, how the rapid response, you know, and having some sort of like an infrastructure set up for rapid response, but also watching people coming out for the first time demonstrating out here in central Pennsylvania who never been involved in politics.
No, that's absolutely. And I think when we saw the first absolute explosion of protests around the country beginning last Friday night, really, but into Saturday, especially all over the country, and not just like in, you know, not just in New York and Los Angeles or something like this, but, you know, smaller airports, but especially places where you have concentrations of refugees. But more to your point is that it didn't just stop with the protests at the airports, right? And the kind of, you know, legal actions taking place. You had rallies across the state. So, you know, we had Seth Goldstein had made it down to Philadelphia for some of the protests. But you have been, kind of on hand for a bunch of this stuff in central Pennsylvania. So kind of walk us through a little bit about, what you've been able to kind of at least report on this past week firsthand, what's happening on the ground in central PA.
So the first thing I'll just go run in order. Tuesday, I went to two demonstrations. Tuesday with Toomey was at like 11:30 in the morning, 11:45, ran till like 1 o'clock. And then the second thing I went to was a vigil in Lancaster in the town square, Penn Square, right in the backdrop of the old market. I don't know if you've ever been to Lancaster before, like the actual city. It's a nice little city southeast of Harrisburg. And the two demonstrations were different in themselves, but also like really interesting to see. You know, the first week, Tuesday with Toomey's out in Harrisburg, 15 people showed up. They're all from Berks County. Last week, about 100 people, mostly women, showed up to this event.
Incredible.
You know, protesting for the ACA, transgender rights, what the ACA does for women and people living in poor communities. So that was outside of Toomey's office. And then later on that night, I went down to Lancaster City, and over 2,000 people showed up for a vigil in the main square. And I was talking to organizers beforehand, and it's like, yeah, this has the potential of being the biggest rally in Lancaster's history. And they said, that's only with like 1,000 people here. That's, you know, incredible. You had people there who's like, I've been a Lancaster resident for 40 years and I have never seen anything like this in my life. I never seen a rally this big. The crowd grew to over 2,000 people by the time it started at 6 o'clock in the morning, or no, 6 o'clock at night in the main square. You had people, there was a main park, right? You know, there's a main park, and then that's where the stage was set up. Big speakers. Speakers were provided by the local bar right down the street, which is having a concert going on. And then across the street, there's maybe like 500 people gathered in the park across the street, you know, because everyone was going down the sidewalks and the overflow from the park was going down the sidewalks on both sides and into the park across the street. The speakers there were absolutely amazing. You know, before the rally started, I was able to get pictures, as I was taking pictures of the crowd coming in. I had someone pull on my backpack and said, hey, you need to interview these two people over here. And they showed me their camera. I'm like, well, why? And he's like, this lady right here just got into the country 2 days before Donald Trump signed his Muslim ban executive order. Mm-hmm. And so it was a mother and daughter who are two refugees from Baghdad, Iraq. They left in the daughter left in 2008. She was able to get she was escaping terrorism, and she was explaining that her brother was killed by these terrorists in Baghdad, and her son was kidnapped. Man. So she made it over into the United States in 2008, and she was trying to get her mother. She's been trying to get her mother to come over since that time, and she was able to get her mother in 2 days before Donald Trump signed the executive order.
That's incredible. I mean, when you first told me that story, I mean, it kind of stopped you in your tracks, right? I mean, that you know, woman's here just by luck, right? Just the fact that she got here 2 days before the order comes down. Otherwise, she could have been like stuck, or, you know, not only maybe having not being able to come here, like from Iraq, or it could be in some sort of makeshift detention center someplace.
And this was an older lady, had to be in her 60s. You know, she had to be in her 60s. And it's like, it puts that face to the story. While these are both just a bunch of terrorists coming over here. No, these are people escaping terrorism. They're coming here. These aren't terrorists that we're letting in.
No, exactly. I mean, and as you hear some of the stories about some of the people that were detained, right, or some of the families that are disrupted and so on, this is a story that was what's that?
A 4-month-old who needed open heart surgery, or a 4-year-old gets sent back to their country.
Yeah, you've got that stuff. And then on the other hand of it, right, you also have – there's been a backlog, right? There's been a squeeze on visas, right? There was a promise that was given to translators that work with American military in Iraq, right, or Afghanistan and things like this, where there were translators that were promised that they were able to kind of come to the U.S. Because these are people that put their lives on the line, right, to help the American military forces in terms of their, you know, for translation and stuff, because they became target of different terrorist organizations because they were kind of, you know, helping the Americans. So they were saying, well, listen, you help us out, you know, we'll make sure you get passage to the U.S. But there was a squeeze on the number of those visas. And some of the people that are caught up in these detention things are people that were these translators, like the few that were actually making them way through. So you've got stories of, like, you know, these babies, right, who are victims of this, you know, unthought through and kind of just really cruel executive order. And then you've got people that we made promises to bring it over. And I could see nothing good coming out of this, both in terms of our relations internationally, but also for the people that are directly involved.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's so you have that Friday night, there's going to be another massive rally in Harrisburg. There's going to be another massive protest and march in Philadelphia on Saturday. I mean, it's amazing seeing this resistance. I mean, I feel like over the past weekends, and one of the things I've noticed at these protests that really gives me like a bright hope is how the parents who are attending these protests are bringing their children to these.
Yes.
I must have saw hundreds of kids in the crowd at the vigil on Sunday or on Tuesday night in Lancaster. You know, there are parents who are bringing their children anywhere from stroller aged up to like 9, 10, 13, 14, 15 years old. They're coming down out to these rallies in protest. I don't know about you, but I would never have thought going to a demonstration with my parents that age, because my parents weren't political. You know, and there wasn't that type of activism going on growing up in Philadelphia. But like, it's great seeing that these kids are knowing what's going on with Trump, and that they're joining that. They're going to be part of that culture and fighting back over the next several years.
No, exactly. You know, and I have someone, you know, I take my kids to stuff all the time. I take my kids to rallies and to protests. And, you know, I've got this great picture of my daughter she was still in a stroller. She was starting to walk. She was still in a stroller, but we went out to kind of support, you know, our Walmart strikers, right, on Black Friday up in Allentown. And, you know, it's always been my thought is like, you know, I want this to just be part of the way my kids understand the world. But, you know, I'm the, you know, political freak, right? This is the kind of stuff that I do all the time. And the fact that you're seeing a much broader swath of people bring their kids. I mean, this is the best training, the best education you can give kids about what it means to actually be part of a democratic culture. Forget just the voting stuff. That's of course is important, obviously, as we saw this past fall. But it's also what it means to actually be an active participant, right? A citizen in the small C, not one, whether you have papers or not, but are you going to be a participant in kind of building and sustaining a vibrant, inclusive democratic culture or not. So this is great news. And, you know, this is, you know, and it wasn't alone in what you saw. I mean, if you look at, if people go to RagingChickenPress.org, you look at the reporting from Lou Ryan out in Pittsburgh and the photos that she took of the rallies out in Pittsburgh this past week, you also see lots of kids there. You look at the photos that Seth Goldstein took, posted up in his coverage of some of the actions down in Philadelphia. You see kids in those two as well. I mean, this is not your standalone activists, you know, people that are normally out there organizing this stuff. Yes, they're there too, right? But this is an outcrying of a community basically saying, we're going to take a stand over the kind of community that we want. And what we're seeing coming out from the Trump organization is diametrically opposed to what we want in our community. So listen, we're just about coming up to a break, and I know we've barely seemed to scratch the surface on some things, but we got to come up to a break. After the break, we're going to kind of turn the lens a little bit closer here to home in Pennsylvania to look at some of the actions in a little bit more detail. Sean has got a really important article that he just published yesterday, I believe, where it looks like the state Senate may be pushing forward a 20-week abortion ban that is kind of flying under the radar right now simply because of the insanity happening in D.C. And on the second thing we'll also look at is looking back at the news conference that was held by Frank Brogan and the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, which is their annual State of the System address, in which they're basically laying the groundwork to dismantle public higher education in the state. They didn't get what they wanted from the last round of contract negotiations with the faculty union. Instead, they got a strike, right, and a successful fight by faculty. So they're looking to kind of extract what they want in different ways. So there's that. And then we just got a kind of cool little anecdote, a little story from this past week at Kutztown University to show that this kind of, I don't know what to call it other than a spirit of resistance, a spirit of, you know, standing up, you know, the idea that, hey, maybe having a spine is a good thing. You'll see what happened at Kutztown University. That kind of flies in the face of the way that a lot of people think about politics. The idea that, yeah, we can go protest out there, but, you know, we don't want to necessarily do it right in our own yard because, you know, because we're afraid, right? We're afraid to want to, you know, piss in our own yard, right? We're going to do it all over there. Instead of doing that, however, we saw faculty wage a small but very successful and kind of, I think, important campaign kind of looking forward. So we'll get into that after the break. Anyway, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. We'll be back, and yeah, we'll just stay right at it. We'll be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1908. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on the Lowe versus Lawler case, also known as the Danbury Hatters case. In 1902, the United Hatters of North America attempted to organize the fur hat company, D.E. Lowe & Company. Lowe refused to meet with the union. The union struck and called for a nationwide boycott of Lowe hats. The AFL assisted in popularizing the boycott. They worked to convince retailers and customers not to buy from Lowe. The company sued the union's business agent and hundreds of its members. Lowe claimed the union violated the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 by interfering with interstate commerce. The Sherman Act had been designed to control big business monopolies, trusts, and cartels like the Standard Oil Company. An 1893 case, United States versus Workingmen's Amalgamated Council of New Orleans, established that the Sherman Sherman Act applied to labor unions as well. In the Danbury Hatters case, the Supreme Court ruled that the union combined to restrain trade or commerce among several states. The union countered by arguing that the union did not interfere with the transportation of hats and were not themselves engaged in interstate commerce. But the union lost. In addition to violating the Sherman Act, the court argued that individual union members could be held personally liable for damages incurred by their unions. The union was eventually held liable in damages amounting to $235,000. The AFL pushed back, demanding reforms in the Sherman Act. Partial reforms came with the Clayton Antitrust Act of 1914, but it would be another 20 years before the Norris LaGuardia Act would exempt organized labor from antitrust injunctions. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. So, folks, we've had some technical issues like all morning long. So bear with us a little bit. If you hear a little change in tones and things like this, everything from our video stream to the normal ways we record this thing to the drivers on our computers have been acting up for us all morning. So
it's Donald Trump's fault.
It's got to be. I mean, you know, it's got to be, right? So if you hear that change on Sean's end, that's why we're doing the best we can to keep the audio and video going. But holy moly, you know, this is it's the kind of stuff that makes you paranoid, right? It makes you like, you know, oh, my God, you know, they're messing with our tech here. So anyways, before the break, we were talking about, you know, it's kind of mass protests. We're talking about this new kind of culture of protest that's moving up. And right here in Pennsylvania, we've had Tuesdays with Toomey. And we talked a little bit about this last week on the program. And, you know, Sean walked us through a little bit of the history that has been around since last November. Is that right, Sean?
Right. It's been around since November. It was started by like a group of women, between like 5-10 women, would start meeting up with Senator Toomey staffers in the Philadelphia field office on a weekly basis every Tuesday. And then it's something that like went on kind of like started bubbling up a little bit, you could say. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say unnoticed, but it started bubbling up to the point where activists in Pittsburgh picked it up at the beginning of in January. So this is fairly recent, like a month ago. Mm-hmm. And now it's to the point where like, you know, maybe 50 people were coming out at that point in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. Now it's to the point where hundreds of people are coming out in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. You almost got 100 out here in Harrisburg. You got people going out in Johnstown, of all places. And then also in Scranton, any other place, or Allentown, where his field offices are at. So and they start out by just like having a single issue. They bring that single issue up every week. And then they, you know, they have a new issue the following week to bring up. And each week it's that singular issue. So it's a pretty good wide ranging list of concerns that they bring up. And one of the things they've been really hammering to me on lately has been Betsy DeVos, and how he looks like he's not going to be supporting DeVos, but
this is actually starting to make national news now, because you've had two Republicans who've come out and said that that they are going to vote, they are not going to support Betsy DeVos in the vote, and you only need three, right? So I guess there's Susan Collins from Maine, and what's her name? I'm just spacing her name from Alaska. Yeah, Murkowski from Alaska. It's basically saying that, you know, no, they're not going to support DeVos. They don't think she's qualified. And so you need one more. And the concentration, or the you know, saying that Toomey is probably the one that has supposedly can be moved the most, right? And I think it's in part because they recognize the organizing happening around Toomey and the pressure being put on Toomey. I know that we're getting constant messages this past week to make sure you call Toomey's offices. I have a list of phone numbers. And, you know, I was calling all week. I could not get through. And, you know, people were actually breaking out fax machines that they hadn't used in a long time just to get messages to Toomey's offices. And there was, you know,
supposedly he had like 900 faxes in a day.
Exactly. Over 1,000. It actually has gone over 1,000. I mean, it's like, you know, unbelievable the number of faxes that have gone into his office. And, you know, this is some phenomenal organizing. But the question is still hanging in the air. Is it going to make any difference? Right. A lot of these right wing politicians, they just tune out from their constituents.
Right. And that's actually not so there's actually a speaking about tuning out. There's also a couple of other things going on here. So supposedly I heard, you know, just talking to people in the Capitol, people who are in that political game saying or hearing that Toomey's staff does not know how to handle this. They're just completely freaking out over the sheer volume of phone calls they're getting in. There's reports that they're turning off their phones and answering machines and just not even. What I like to think is like what they're doing is like they have a record player playing in the background. They have like those huge earphones on and just like make pretend nothing's going on. Like, you know, like you see like those memes, like the chimps working on the like at the desk and mm-hmm. they have the headphones on. That's what I think is going on over in Toomey's offices. I think people just got these big Bose headphones on and are just blocking out all the background noise because basically no one's getting through from who I talk to.
No, I'll tell you, I've called multiple times. And when I first started calling early in the day on maybe it was even Tuesday, when the strong push came out, I started calling the office and initially I'd get connected and then I'd get put on hold and then you'd wait for a little bit and then it'd be like, I'm sorry, you brought a call back later, right? And then you hear that once in a while. Then it went to you call and you'd connect, but then you'd hear nothing and then it would go off and then it would just be busy signals. Like someone actually literally just took the phone off the hook and left it sit there on the desk.
Or you have people just pick up the phone, putting it down, picking it up, putting it down, picking it up, putting it back on the receiver and like going like that. Like just like
the music one and two and down and up and down. But it was pretty amazing. And I was calling the Allentown office, calling the Philadelphia offices, you know, any number that I had, and I just could not get through anywhere.
I saw so Senator Casey's actually getting a lot of stuff on this too. Mm-hmm. He put out a tweet this morning that I think like constituent response is up 900 or 9,000% over the past month compared to last year, all over DeVos. He said he's gotten over like 1,000 handwritten letters about DeVos personally.
Wow.
From people mailing him. So people are letting their other senators know that they don't want DeVos becoming the next Department of Education secretary.
I'm really happy to hear that. And, you know, and Casey, you know, it can be hard on Casey at times, but, you know, Casey has, you know, did come out and say he's not going to vote for DeVos.
He's actually been pretty quite active lately. He showed up to the airports. He's been in the news. He's up for re-election in 18, right?
No, that's right. But, you know, I think more importantly is like, you know, Casey has the reputation of being, the guy who's off in the corner.
Elder statesman.
And people are like, who's the other senator? Oh, right. Casey, where is that guy? Right. What are you? He hasn't said anything. And now, I mean, he's actually engaged in some pointed questioning in some of the confirmation hearings. He, like you said, he's actually been showing up places and not showing up places to say that, yes, I know I'm a Democrat, but I'm strongly against abortion. I mean, that's where you'd normally hear him come out. Right. But now he's actually kind of emboldened a bit, I think, by the activism. And I think that's the important message to get out from activists is that you're actually giving them the support of the spine that they should have already. Right. To take these actions. You let them know that this is the side you want to be on when you're going to be moving forward into elections.
And one of the things is like Casey and his family have a history in Pennsylvania of being that statesman, coming from a family of statesmen, like a family of well-respected legislators and politicians. His dad was governor. He's the senator of Pennsylvania. And I feel like he's figuring out, hey, I could still be like that respected statesman, but also be very outspoken on this because of the attacks on the institution itself. And that's what I think is probably prompting him.
That's a great point. And I think that, you know, you have a lot of people, a lot of, you know, politicians who kind of come out of similar kinds of traditions, suddenly realizing you have to rethink what it means to be like a statesman, what it means to be that kind of identity they had before when you're not in normal times. And I think, you know, Casey was a little bit slow on the uptake on this one to realize that you can't just behave in this normal way. You can't kind of, you know, do the Obama thing, go high. right? Because look, that low and high is no longer kind of, we've lost our orientation when it comes to normal political processes. So that's good. But, you know, so that's all good there, right? You've got major pressure on Toomey. We still don't know if he's going to cave or not. We're right at that point where, you know, we've got a 50-50 vote on DeVos. I guess the vote's going to be next week. It came out of hearing, you were telling me before, at 6:30 this morning, right?
Yeah.
And so next week we can expect a vote. Looks like it'd probably be a 50-50 unless Toomey actually decides to vote against DeVos. So this, and which would be kind of almost unprecedented. So that's good. You also see some spying of the Democrats in the hearing kind of nationwide. But I want to stay in Pennsylvania for a bit here, because you had, I think, a really important story that I don't think is getting the kind of coverage that it really needs, or it's getting some coverage, but it's not getting the attention that it needs to. In the midst of, you know, the fire hose of insanity coming from D.C., we see right here in Pennsylvania some of the, you know, the right wing kind of anti-woman, anti-abortion folks gearing up to actually push through some legislation that's, you know, potentially extraordinarily harmful to women.
Exactly. The Senate Republicans are planning on pushing Senate Bill 3, which, if you remember last year, was House Bill 1948, and that was the 20-week abortion ban, and it would ban all abortions, even in the case of rape, incest, or miscarriage, or potential miscarriage, or deformity to the fetus. And it will ban all those forms of abortion after the 20th week. Senate Republicans are planning on pushing this next week. The bill was referred to the Senate Judiciary Committee just yesterday, and I ended up getting tipped off by a couple of my sources within the House and Senate on this. So they are very confident that the Senate Republicans are going to begin to move on this and potentially try to do the same thing they did last year. Vote on it on a Monday with little no notice in the committee, have it sit on first consideration, then second and third consideration, and then vote on it by Wednesday. So this could potentially be through the Senate by Wednesday. The thing is, Republicans have a supermajority hold in the Senate, but there's some Republicans who will not vote for this bill, most likely out of the Philadelphia area, you know, Southeastern Republicans who are still pro-choice. What the thing is that there might be enough Democrats in the Senate caucus to actually give them that 34 vote, supermajority vote.
So, and the supermajority vote is important because it could override the veto from Wolf, right? Right.
So if Governor Wolf was to veto this bill, they might have enough ammunition to run it through again and override it.
This is crazy.
And there's enough Democrats in both chambers to give votes to Republicans to give them a supermajority, a potential supermajorities in the House and Senate to override this bill. And there's only been two bills overridden by a governor's veto in the past 20 years. And then, so this is potentially historic, and this is something to definitely keep an eye on.
No, absolutely. And, you know, this only underscores like how important it is to have someone like you out there, Sean, that it's actually, you know, not just kind of reporting that this thing is coming up, but understanding like the details of the politics in that state house, which is, you know, again, is, you know, we've been talking about this for years, but how important it is to have this kind of like, you know, kind of investigative stuff on the ground reporting at the state level, not just at the national level, because, you know, I don't think if you look at some of the coverages of how this, that has been covered, nobody seems to be running the numbers exactly in the way that you are. So kudos to you for getting this out.
And there's also another Tuesday, so actually this Tuesday is pretty interesting. Now there's Tuesdays with Toomey, right? Mm-hmm. Again, people are going about to meet there, but there's also the budget address Tuesday afternoon.
That's this coming Tuesday.
That's this Tuesday. Yes. The budget is this coming Tuesday.
My God.
And so we're getting ready for the long haul. Well, some of the Tuesdays with Toomey people did not realize that. Like they're already saying, hey, we'll go into the Capitol Tuesday to talk to our legislators on this. And I really don't think they understand that they have an opportunity here to really get in their legislators' face over this, as as they are giving their press conferences after the governor's address. So there might be some face-to-face confrontation and action over this on Tuesday in the Capitol. So definitely keep your eyes safe towards that, because there's some people saying they're going to seek out their legislators on Tuesday afternoon to do this. And this is when the Republicans and all the other politicians put their charade on in the Capitol Rotunda, giving their press conferences, interviews, and stuff like this. So there might be a little... Might be a little bit extra going on this budget address on Tuesday.
Awesome. I'd like to see that. Hey, you know, before I forget, I meant to ask you about this before we went on air too, but just completely just slipped my mind. The other big news that's starting to come out, what we're hearing about potential legislation coming forward is right to work stuff. What's the status on that coming out of Harrisburg right now? I mean, they look like they want to push that bill too as well. And some early indications are that Tom Wolf might not just be, you know, might not be ready to fight against right to work legislation.
I haven't heard anything about that.
CIO has been pushing that out. It looks like that they're trying to put in legislation too as well on a relatively short timeline.
Bills are coming through.
Yeah. So that's something we're gonna have to follow up with for next week and kind of dig into that, because right now basically, after the election of Trump at the national level, and the fact that Scott Wagner, right, you know, who's, you know, thrown his hat in for the next round of governor's race, is the right to work legislation, paycheck deception stuff is Scott Wagner's hobby horses. They look like they think this is the time to strike to try to push this legislation through. And if that happens, you're basically going to look, you know, you're going to, you know, not exactly break the back, but you're going to put a dagger right in the back of labor. So that is the other thing that's coming down the pike here at the statewide level.
I don't see Governor Wolf signing that, though.
Well, I don't know if he will sign it in terms of totally support it, but he might actually then just kind of let it become law. This is what I was curious to what your take was on this, because I'm hearing some different things that they want to push this legislation to go through, and that Wolf may be trying to position himself as some sort of, you know, budget compromise to get, so it doesn't have to go through the budget fight. But the exchange just may be kind of right to work legislation. So, I mean, again, this is, that's why I was curious for your take on it, what you're hearing on the ground there, because this is just what I'm hearing kind of second, third hand. I don't know to what degree that is just expressing people's anxieties, or if that's actually something that's going on.
Well, if Governor Wolf, I guess, was to put the knife in the back of labor, I think that would be the end of his political career. People are worried that he might be darting towards the center, but during this election, but I can't see him supporting that unless he wants to get thrown out of, not get reelected.
Well, we'll see. You know, I'm not going to take anything off the table for what's even possible at this point. I mean, who knows? Maybe he already sees the writing on the wall and sees that, you know, maybe he's got people saying that he's not going to win the next round of he's not going to be reelected. So he's just trying to get a budget pass and move through. I mean, look, that's pure like conjecture. It has nothing to do. That's not based in reality or what I know. But, you know, I think that's something we need to dig in there too as well. So one quick thing too is before we go into the last segment, we'll see if we have anything fun to say in the last part. But the other news from last week, last Thursday, they had the State of the University address that came out of from PASHE, the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education. And what was very interesting about that session is basically the State System of Higher Education has announced that they are undergoing basically a top to bottom study about how the university system works. The context for this is that during the last round of contract negotiations with the faculty union, ABSCUF, what the state system wanted was basically to create a two-tiered faculty system, right? Basically turn a good chunk of the faculty into part-time adjuncts, was to give more quote-unquote flexibility to universities, basically to eliminate programs. A whole bunch of stuff that was just really, would have been really, really bad for higher education. Things like forcing students, even students that are living on campus, to take distance education classes and so on. And the faculty union successfully fought all that stuff back, right? ABSCUF members took a little bit of a hit when it comes in terms of salary and benefits, but the academics were able to bolster that up. This is a pattern we've seen in the past. When PASHI does not get what it wants during its contract, it turns to alternative means. On the last round of contract negotiations 4 years ago, what happened after they did not get what they wanted, which was similar to what they wanted this time, they turned to retrenchments, was basically the firing of full-time faculty and tenured faculty members, the elimination of programs and so on through a particular provision in the contract. That's what they did this time. This time around, if you go and you listen to that, Frank Brogan's speech in particular, he seems to want to fashion himself, I don't know, someone who's passionate about higher education. Sounds like some sort of forced minister, right? He tried to sound passionate, but he doesn't pull it off very well. But basically saying we're going to do this top to bottom evaluation and nothing is off the table. And they said that, you know, this may entail closing of universities. So this is going to be something that we're going to have to watch extraordinarily carefully. They've also opened the floodgates once again for new tuition schemes. So if you remember, we reported on this a lot last year. PASHI was putting forward what they're calling paper credit tuition schemes, which would basically cause tuition to increase between 15 and 25% to universities. And some of the universities have got to pass through. The rest of that was stopped. But this is all coming forward, right? So we have budget address next week from the governor. There's going to be a big budget fight. And part of what's going to happen with that budget fight is it's going to impact all these other discussions. There's a reason why PASHI is announcing now that it is going to undergo this revision. It's hiring an outside consultant to come in and kind of evaluate everything. And that is now going to be embedded in this round of budget talks. So pay attention to that. So much more. I just got to shut my mouth to Sean, because I'm just like, I'm telling you, there's so many more things that are kind of coming up that I think we're going to have to pay attention to. But I have one other thing that I want to say, but I'm going to wait until the final segment, because it's about as fun as you get it on my end of things. It's about a little faculty resistance at Kutztown University to a dead rat. We'll have more.
Oh,
about
God,
that.
Was this in Lytle Hall?
Yeah, it was in Lytle Hall. So we'll come back after the break to talk about the dead rat in the wall in Lytle Hall and some of the creative ways that faculty pushed back against that and actually got some action. We're seeing the kind of organizing culture happening everywhere right now, and it's the one thing that warms my beating heart. We're going to be right back after this message. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor of Raging Chicken. We'll see you for a little bit of fun right after this.
This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism. And frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. So usually in this last segment, we like to talk about beer and some other stuff. But you know what? How about you all choose your own beer this week, unless Sean's got some kind of idea of something to drink or something like that. But I think the joy this week, the good news of this week is going to come into acts of resistance and some upcoming stuff. So we're going to kind of close on that note. So the little story I have, the little anecdote from Kutztown University, is has to do with Lytle Hall. Lytle Hall was built in about 1970s, sometime in there, 1980s or so. I like to call it Legoland. It's actually the building in which I work, right? Some people call it Lytle House on the Prairie because it's like the building that is like the farthest from everything else. And it's, you know, it's crowded. It doesn't even meet current code. Some stuff was grandfathered in on it. It has persistent issues, odors. Let's say. What's that?
Odors,
right? So I'll give you an example. When I first came to Kutztown in 2002, that following summer, I think it was 2003, it might have been a year after that, but I had come in to teach the summer class, and I noticed that there was just weird stuff on the walls. It looked like somebody had, like, scrubbed the walls, or I couldn't figure it out, right? So I asked somebody who had been around there for a long time. You know, I was new. And I said, what's up with the walls? They look all grayish or something like this. It's like, oh, that's the mold. And I'm like, that's the mold? I mean, like your friend, the mold? I mean, they're like, oh, yeah, every summer it gets really humid in here, and the air conditioning stuff, the HVAC stuff doesn't work so well. So it actually begins to kind of like condense on the walls, and then the mold grows.
And this is stuff they shut down schools for.
Exactly, right? So, and I was like, I are you freaking kidding me? This is not okay. This is not okay, right? To have mold growing on your freaking walls in the hallways, right? And so I said, because if it's growing in the walls in the hallway, imagine what's happening like in places you don't see that are dark and steamy, right?
Bring a respirator to work day.
No, exactly. And so it took almost a year, right? At that point, I was involved with our faculty union at that point, and it took almost a year to get any attention to that until finally, after threatening to kind of like, you know, blow it up, like, you know, by contacting like the EPA and all sorts of stuff like this, that they finally came out and realized, oh, maybe we're going to need to do something about this. And we've basically forced them to do a health study and did air testing. And sure enough, there's freaking mold everywhere. So now in the summers in Lytle Hall, you have these giant things that look like giant garbage cans that are dehumidifiers that suck some of that air out of that. Because the HVAC system has not been repaired, right? It's not been fixed. So you have this kind of way to mitigate this. So that was over a decade ago. Right. And there's been ongoing issues. Right. There's people who have asthma, who have respiratory issues and things like this. People getting weird, you know, sicknesses and illnesses. But people who came in actually with asthma and this kind of stuff have consistently had problems in their offices. So,
yeah, it's probably one of the worst fucking buildings on Kutztown's campus.
Oh, my God. It's horrendous. Well, but you know, we should say, you know, in some of the newer buildings, we have other kinds of issues. Like when they built BAME, BAME was a science building. And because they were, you know, low bidding contracts and things like this, when they put together their HVAC system in BAME, they had it hooked up wrong. Right. So it actually started kind of raining in the building because it was feeding back in cold air and hot, humid air. And it was like, you know, basically creating its own scientific experiment. So they had to kind of redo that. But in BAME this past year, too, as well, there was a smell in BAME and people are saying, what is this? Right. And it turns out there was a chemical that, you know, depending on who you're asking, a potentially toxic chemical that had spilled, right? And the gas was flooding the hallways in there. And it took them days to act on that, right? They said, oh, it's just a bad smell. And they're like, well, what is it? And they're like, well, we don't know. It's a science building.
There's people a bad smell coming inside the science.
Yeah, right. Show me a sentence that ends well, right? When you start it
bad
like that.
Bad smell in science building.
Yeah. There's a bad smell coming from the science building, right? Oh, it's popcorn. No, it's not. Bad smell from the science building is you the kind of thing
you want to check. Probably one of those physics professors smoking weed or something. Like, you know, it's
crazy, right? Just crazy. So anyway, so here's my little bit of joy for this. So this, you know, the beginning of this semester, when faculty came back to Lytle Hall, they noticed that when you walked in the front doors, the little kind of alcove area of the stairwell, you walk in that front door and there was a stench, right? And the stench smelled kind of like rotting flesh, right? It smelled like something that was decaying. Right. And as the days went on, it got progressively worse. Complaints were filed. Work orders were filed, by faculty, by staff members. Students were complaining about it. You hear them talking the hall. What the heck is that smell? Right. And it just the smell got worse. And pretty soon you could see, you could tell where it was coming from. It was coming from this one part in the alcove. But what are you going to do? So there's a heating unit right there, right? And then if you put your nose close to the heating unit, which I just would not do that, but some other people did, and they nearly got sick. They realized it was coming from there. So work orders were filed. Our faculty union, they had a meet and discuss with the administration, went to them and said, look, this is a problem. There's a stench there and all this kind of stuff. There were work orders that were filed, and the administration said, well, there's really nothing we can do. We actually have the paper trail of this. The administration sent one of the staff members an email back saying, well, we had to reject the work order to go and try to figure it out. Because if there's a dead rodent or something that's rotting, it's probably in the wall. Right. And then that's what we think is there. But so nothing we can really do about that. But we have authorized the liberal use of Febreze to cover over the smell. Right. Because, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with inhaling the kind of like the gases from like decaying flesh. Right.
And on top of that, you get your daily dose of chlorofluorocarbons and propellant coming out of the cans of Febreze.
Why not? But I'll tell you, you know what's almost as worse as kind of like having to kind of be greeted by decaying flesh as you walk into work every day? It's decaying flesh and Febreze together floating around in a stairwell that's closed on both ends. Right? It's disgusting. So when the faculty union met with the administration, they said, we need this taken care of. And they said, faculty union basically said, okay, look, we've been at this long enough. And matter of fact, it's not just this smell. It's like the persistent mold. And we have pictures now of inside the ceiling tiles of black mold still in there, mouse droppings and things like this, all inside the, like in the ceilings, a whole bunch of other issues, decaying pipes and corroding pipes in the air conditioning and heating units, a whole bunch of other things that the administration has refused to address. And so this went to a complaint that went forward to Pennsylvania Labor and Industry. And, the faculty union was basically like, look, we need to have this stuff addressed. This complaint is moving forward because nothing has been done. And they're like, well, we don't know. We'll have to look into it, blah, blah, blah. This goes on. Nothing moves. Nothing happens. So Monday, right, this past Monday, I show up to work, right, and I'm walking in, and I get to the front door of my hall, and there is a billboard, a sandwich board set up there, with a stenchometer, the Lytle Hall stenchometer. And it's a yellow sign. And I'll post a picture of this, right? And I'm kind of embedded up. There's a yellow sign that has an arrow that you can move, right? Where it starts on the left-hand side, starts like, how does Lytle smell? How does Lytle smell today? Right. On the one end, fresh as a daisy. On the other end, it says Lytle Hall. But before you get to Lytle Hall, it's Mordor. Right. So you would have folks that would be turning that. Right. So you have fresh as a daisy, new car, Stratton administration building, wet dog, dead rodent in wall, burning dumpster, moldy ceiling tiles, Mordor or Lytle Hall. Right. And so basically students were coming up and seeing this, laughing, right, coming over to see it, taking selfies in front of it and so on. Right. The picture gets posted up on the faculty union Facebook page, and students are posting this stuff up, and it goes nuts. Right. And meanwhile, the local media starts calling the faculty union, starts calling the university about what the hell is happening in Lytle Hall. Right. So multiple interviews are set up and all this. And then guess what happens, right? Before the end of the day on Monday, right, two workers, right, and a team of vice presidents, right, because apparently they want to demonstrate urgency here.
Hashtag never forget.
Exactly. Come over to Lytle Hall, right, disassemble the heating unit, and sure enough, there is a rodent, right, some sort of rodent. I didn't actually see it, but, you know, I saw the kind of the nest part, the nest of kind of rodents in there that were all dead and that were all rotting. And they pulled it out, right, and fixed it. And got moved on. And then, like, the president of the university and the provost of the university wants to meet with the faculty union to make sure we address the Lytle issues. I mean, this is crazy, right? So anytime, this is the reminder that, you know, of anytime you say, like, hey, we're all in this together. You know, sometimes there are more people, there are some people that are in it for the right reasons, some of them for the wrong reasons. And it's that one lesson that we learned from the faculty strike this past year is that when we look at our campus and we talk about it as our campus, right? who's included in that R is primarily the faculty and the students, right? Too often we are working at odds with the administration, right? Especially administrations that are all they're concerned about is how to kind of squeeze from the bottom line and kind of institute austerity policies. So fighting back works, folks. And to see that happening from the national scale, right, for these amazing marches that are out there, right down to the kind of, you know, your local workplace, you know, and there's a lot of people that get worried about, kind of raising Cain, so to speak, where you work, right, because it's your own backyard, you know, is that old phrase, don't piss in your own backyard. But this is what we have to do these days, right? It's not just out there is the problem. The problem's on how we take control of our lives, how we take control and take, you know, back the power in this democracy, is we're willing to stand up in our everyday spaces, not just in some abstract political spaces, but the very places that we work, in which we live, in which we're seeing. So that's my little fun story for the week. What do you got for us, Sean?
Oh, man, nothing can top that, but there's another round of demonstrations going on. You know, in Philadelphia and Harrisburg, Sunday night outside the Capitol, 2 o'clock in the or Sunday afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there's going to be a rally to support immigrant rights and the immigrant community in central Pennsylvania. And then there's going to be a march afterwards. This is being put together by our friend Joy Marie Manbeck from the Harrisburg area, and a couple of other Bernie grassroots activists. And then there's another march going on Saturday afternoon in Philadelphia, which is SEPTA, I think, is like offering riders options to use the rails to get to these protests, which is actually pretty good. Because I'm sure SEPTA is seeing a lot of increase in ridership with people going to these protests all the time.
Yeah, you think? Suddenly there is no off-peak time.
Yeah.
It's all peak, and I think that's what we got to keep it. Oh, and I should say, you know, the other little anecdote from last night, right, is that Seth Goldstein was out there, you know, Billy Penn, just as his little kind of publication down in Philadelphia, Billy Penn had just published a list of all the upcoming protests for the month of February so far, and there's dozens of them.
And there's right? a lot and, more not even there's a lot more not even like up there. You know, I'm going through exactly. my Facebook feed. I woke up this morning. I had to wake up like 7:30 because I had to move my car because I was parked in a non-authorized parking area. So at 8 o'clock, they just start ticketing everyone. Uh-huh. I was scrolling through my Facebook feed. The Philly socialists mm-hmm. are tearing shit up right now in Philadelphia.
That's right.
DSA, Socialist Alt, and other socialist groups are just are really seizing this opportunity. This time is an opportunity to grow their ranks and to get people out to their demonstrations. I think there's been a profile on a few of the socialist organizations. So Temple is a really big socialist hub. I always knew that, but I didn't know why. The chair of the DSA actually teaches at Temple University, mm-hmm. National Democratic Socialist of America. So there's a strong DSA presence and socialist alternative presence on Temple's campus. They've been organizing the communities for the past several months, especially in the Temple area about the stadium that's being built. And they successfully pushed that back so far for months on end. They've been fighting this thing back and they've been organizing the community. They've been organizing people around like 15 now actions.
Yeah.
And they're just tearing stuff up. I saw last night they held a resistance meeting on how to peacefully object to deportations and how to protect someone if you're getting deported and how do you peacefully restrain yourself in the most using like, you know, physical acts of restraint, but remaining peaceful. I mean, there's all these trainings going on there across the city right now in Philadelphia, which are absolutely amazing. Like civil disobedience trainings, resistance trainings. The rhetoric I'm hearing coming from the Philadelphia demonstrations are the same things I'm hearing about intersectionality coming out of Harrisburg and Lancaster. So there's a lot of like people are hitting on the right messages and it's coming from your socialist groups.
Well, I tell you that. Absolutely. It's coming from your socialist group and it's coming from where you see emerging activists. Like, so for example, you remember last semester, right, during the faculty strike, the ABSCUF strike, students began organizing on each campus across the state system of higher education, right? And they started to come out in support of students and all that. Support of faculty, right? Standing with faculty on the lines, on the picket lines, and amazing groups came together. And then you started seeing students beginning to organizing across campuses, right? Beginning to kind of build a network across campuses, which became PA Student Power, right? And we've talked with James Sersonsky, right? Is a guy who kind of who's been working with some students, and you have student activists down at Westchester, or at Kutztown, at Indiana, at Millersville, I mean, across the state system. And right now, they just launched a petition 2 days ago, right? Calling for $15 an hour minimum wage for students, faculty, or students and staff, right, on every campus, right? So not only do you have the amazing activism that's happening in the communities, you're seeing this similar kinds of message reverberating and echoing across other spaces too as well, right? It's almost as if you're waiting to see how is this going to kind of congeal in one direction, because it's going, it's absolutely amazing.
I think we're watching a massive awakening right now among the left.
That's a great way of putting it, I think.
There's an awakening going on. I have not felt this jazzed up as an activist since Occupy. You know, going to the Occupy demonstrations, it only lasted like a month and a half, 2 months. I'm going to like two protests a week. There's like three or four or five demonstrations out in Harrisburg, the central Pennsylvania area, a week. Yeah. You know, I was telling someone the other day, you see a demonstration, like a grassroots-led demonstration in Harrisburg or on central Pennsylvania issues out here, maybe once every 5 or 6 months. You don't see multiple demonstrations in a week going on weeks on end. The stuff that's happening out here is unheard of, the organizing efforts that are going on out here and the turnout. You know, 100 people getting out here for Tuesdays with Toomey in Harrisburg, a completely grassroots-driven movement. You know, I was talking to one of the Penn Live people who showed up to that like 10 minutes late. He's like, yeah, I wasn't going to come, but I was on my way. I didn't feel like coming to this. And he's turned around. He's like, holy shit, there's 100 people out in front of the federal building. And he's like, I was not expecting that. You know, I was like, we're talking. It's like this, and plus this isn't people, you know, this isn't your liberal special interest groups, you know, like putting us stuff on. This is grassroots-driven activism happening right here in our state. And it's not even springtime yet.
No, I know, I mean, exactly. The weather's not even good yet. And I think that, you know, I think what one of the key things here too is with all this is those established liberal progressive organizations, labor organizations, and that kind of stuff, they all have decisions to make at this point. They have all decisions because they're going to say, are you going to get on the bus, right? Or are you going to try to kind of like stay off on the side and do what you have been doing before, which has been ineffective, right? And the more that we see organizations being bolstered by the kind of activism and organizing we see, and then kind of say wanting to kind of increase their own militancy, their own kind of public effort, their own kind of direct action, the better off that we're going to be as a whole. So, you know, my message is, you know, I'm a union member, right? Faculty union member. My message is to all my brothers and sisters in ABSCUF and other unions across the state is like, now is also the time to push your own leadership. Now is also the time to kind of organize and kind of making a demand for more militant action, for more direct action, to kind of join with everyone in these communities that is kind of, you know, is doing what we need to do to reclaim our power. So that's
and one of the things, watching Seth's video from last night, I would definitely recommend watching the video. He posted 12-minute video of the anti-discrimination LGBTQ march that went on, mm-hmm. Because that brought members from the LGBT community together, the members from the African American community together, and other members from all different communities together in Philadelphia, which there's been a little bit of a strained relationship between the LGBTQ community and the Black community over the past couple months, especially with some racist incidents happening down in the neighborhood area around in Center City. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems like they're coming together. And one of the videos, one of the parts of the thing, I was listening to this guy saying, it's time for us to put our differences aside and stand up as one. You know, and this is the message that is being said from anyone throughout any place I go to, this is the same stuff I'm hearing, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens once springtime comes around and spring and summer months, because once that weather starts getting nicer around March, I feel like there's going to be a lot more people. I think you're going to see a lot more students getting involved. I think we're going to be seeing a big upswell in the left and in protest.
Yeah, if this keeps on, I mean, we might see a freedom summer that will be kind of unrivaled in American history if this keeps up. So let's keep up. So I say, you know, this is why we wanted to close with this today, because you got to admit, right, in the midst of all the depressing news, right, this right here, the organizing that is going on, the victories that are going on, the kind of people coming together, it is better than beer, folks. I'll tell you that. Not to say that you can't have beer, too, but I'm saying it is better than beer. So We'll get back out there, folks. And just as a reminder, support us, support us, support us. We need your support to keep this stuff going. We're paying our writers now. We're paying folks to kind of, as much as we can. The more members that we get, the more we're going to pay our writers. The money that comes in from our membership is going right back out to our writers, right? That's kind of the idea here. We want to build this kind of sustainable model, and we want to have the kind of report that Sean's doing, kind of reports that Seth is doing, that Lou is doing, that Shreya is doing, right across the board, that Nicole is doing. The stuff that has been posted has been phenomenal. I keep on getting feedback from people saying, wow, you guys are posting a whole lot right now. And I said, yep, because we're finally at the point where, number one, we have no choice. We need to do this. And number two, we can do this thanks to the kind of members that we have out there, the people that have shown us support, the people that send us donations all the time. So please, please, please get out there, ragingchickenpress.org, click on the support and membership tab and find your way. So become a member, become a patron, or make a one-time donation to help keep this going strong. Until then, Sean, I wish you well. I hope you have a great week.
Yep, I definitely will.
Sean's already off doing his work. He's already reading the news on his computer about what's he gonna do next. I was actually just seeing
if anyone's actually been caught up on the reporting about the abortion ban coming up next week, because that's something to keep an eye on. Because we're going to be calling our legislators, not just call your home legislator, but call Frank Dermody and call Mike Hannon and call these Democratic spineless leaders on the Hill and tell them to make sure their members vote against this bill, or they will be repercussions for this.
See that? How can you not want to support this? Before the podcast is even done, Sean's already on to kind of like working on a following up on the story that he posted this week. So anyway, we will see you next week. Get out there to the pages of Raging Chicken Press. It looks like we're going to have an app that is going to be coming out very soon too as well, which I'm very excited about. We're also going to have some other announcements kind of coming down the road, but it's a little bit too much to go into right now, so I'm just going to leave it until next week. Look for us on Facebook Live, get to our Facebook page and like it, and get to our Raging Chicken Press or go to support membership tab and become a member. This is Kevin Mahoney. I am the editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I'm charged up now. I'm no longer depressed. I'm ready to move forward. We'll talk to you next week. Until then, see ya.